Chapter 7. While he was enjoying himself, watching Aglaé as she talked to Prince N. and Yevgeny Pavlovich, suddenly the elderly Anglomaniac, who was entertaining the dignitary in another corner and with animation telling him some story, uttered the name of Nikolai Andreevich Pavlishchov. Mushkin turned quickly in their direction and began to listen. They were discussing public affairs and some disturbances on estates in the province. There must have been something amusing about the Anglomaniac's account, for the old man began laughing at last at the little sallies of the speaker. He was telling smoothly, and, as it were, peevishly drawling his words, with soft emphasis on the vowel sounds, how he had been obliged, as a direct result of recent legislation, to sell a splendid estate of his in the province, and for half its value too, though he was in no need of money, and at the same time to keep an estate that had gone to ruin, was encumbered and a subject of litigation, and had even to spend money to do so. To avoid another lawsuit about the Pavlishchov estate, I ran away from them. Another inheritance or two of that kind, and I shall be ruined. I should have come in for 9,000 acres of excellent land, however.
Why, of course, Ivan Petrovich is a relation of the late Nikolai Andreevich. You made a search for relations, I believe.
General Epanchin, who happened to be near and noticed Mushkin's marked attention to the conversation, said to him in an undertone. He had till then been entertaining the general, who was the head of his department, but he had for some time been noticing Mushkin's conspicuous isolation and was becoming uneasy. He wanted to bring him to a certain extent into the conversation, and in that way show him off and introduce him a second time to the great personages.
Lyov Nikolaevich was left, on the death of his parents, a ward of Nikolai Andreevich Pavlishchov,
he put in, meeting Ivan Petrovich's eye.
"Delighted to hear it," observed the latter. "And I remember it well indeed. When Ivan Fyodorovich introduced us just now, I knew you at once, and from your face, too. You've changed very little indeed, though you were only 10 or 11 when I saw you. There is something one remembers about your features."
"Did you see me when I was a child?" Mushkin asked with great surprise.
"Yes, very long ago," Ivan Petrovich went on. "At Slatovohova, where you used to live at my cousin's. In old days I used to go pretty often to Slatovohova. Don't you remember me? You might very likely not remember. You were then, you had some sort of illness then, so much so that I was very much struck on one occasion."
"I don't remember at all," Mushkin asserted with warmth.
A few more words of explanation, perfectly calm on the part of Ivan Petrovich, and betraying great agitation on the part of Mushkin, followed, and it appeared that the two elderly maiden ladies, kinswomen of Pavlishchov, who had lived on his estate, Slatovohova, and by whom Mushkin had been brought up, were also cousins of Ivan Petrovich's. The latter was as unable as everyone else to explain what induced Pavlishchov to take so much trouble over his protégé, the little prince.
"It hadn't, in fact, occurred to me to be curious about that.
But yet it appeared that he had an excellent memory, for he remembered how severe his elder cousin, Marfa Nikitishna, had been with her little pupil.
So that on one occasion I stood up for you and attacked her system of education. For the rod, and nothing but the rod, with an invalid child, you'll admit."
"And how tender the younger sister, Natalia Nikitishna, was to the poor child."
They are both," he went on, "in X-province now, though I'm not sure whether they're both living, where Pavlishchov left them an extremely nice little property. I believe Marfa Nikitishna wanted to go into a convent, but I won't be sure. I may be thinking of someone else. Yes, I heard that the other day, about a doctor's wife."
Mushkin listened to this with eyes shining with delight and emotion. With great warmth he declared that he should never forgive himself for not having seized an opportunity to seek out and visit the ladies who had brought him up, though he had been for 6 months in the central provinces. He had been meaning to set off every day, but had been continually occupied with other matters. But that now he was determined, he would certainly, even though it were to X-province.
"So you know Natalia Nikitishna. What a fine, what a saintly nature. But Marfa Nikitishna, too, forgive me, but I think you are mistaken about Marfa Nikitishna. She was severe, but How could she help losing patience with such an idiot as I was then? You know I was a complete idiot, though you saw me then, and how is it that I don't remember you? Tell me, please. So you... My God, are you really a relation of Nikolai Andreevich Pavlishchov?
I assure you I am, said Ivan Petrovich with a smile, scrutinizing Mushkin.
Oh, I didn't say that because I doubted it. And in fact, how could I doubt it? In the least. But I only mean that Nikolai Andreevich Pavlishchov was such a splendid man. A most noble-hearted man, I assure you.
Mushkin was not exactly breathless, but choking with good-heartedness, as Adelaida expressed it next day to her betrothed, Prince S.
Mercy on us, laughed Ivan Petrovich. Why shouldn't I be a relation of a noble-hearted man, even?
Oh, my goodness, cried Mushkin, overcome with confusion and growing more and more hurried and eager. I've said something stupid again, but, well, that's bound to happen because I that's out of place again. And of what consequence am I, pray, besides such interests, such vast interests, and by comparison with such a noble-hearted man? For you know, he really was a noble man, wasn't he? Wasn't he?
Mushkin was positively trembling all over.
Why he was suddenly so agitated, why he was in such a state of ecstasy and emotion, quite irrelevant, and as it seemed out of all proportion with the subject of conversation, it was difficult to decide. He was in such a state of mind, and he almost seemed to feel the warmest and liveliest gratitude to someone for something, perhaps to Ivan Petrovich himself, if not to the whole company. He was bubbling over with happiness. Ivan Petrovich began at last staring at him more fixedly. The dignitary, too, began looking at him with great intentness. Princess Bielokonski looked wrathfully at Mushkin and tightened her lips. Prince N., Yevgeny Pavlovich, Prince S., the young ladies, all broke off their conversation and listened. Aglaya seemed frightened. Lizaveta Prokofievna's heart failed her. They, too, the mother and daughters, had behaved strangely. They had foreseen and decided that it would be better for Mushkin to sit still and be silent the whole evening. But as soon as they saw him sitting in complete solitude, perfectly satisfied with his position, they were at once dreadfully upset. Alexandra had been on the point of going to him across the room and tactfully joining the company, that is, Prince N.'s group, near Princess Bielokonski. And now that Mushkin had begun talking of his own accord, they were even more perturbed.
You are right in saying that he was a most excellent man, Ivan Petrovich pronounced impressively, with no smile now. Yes, yes, he was an excellent man. Excellent and worthy, he added after a pause. Worthy, one may say, of all respect, he added more impressively, after a third pause. And it is very agreeable to see on your part. Wasn't it that, Pavlishchov, that there was a queer story about, with the abbe? Oh, I've forgotten which abbe. Only everybody was talking about it at one time,
the dignitary brought out as though recollecting something.
With the abbe Guru, a Jesuit, Ivan Petrovich recalled. Yes, there you have our most excellent and worthy people, because he was, after all, a man of family and fortune, a Kammerherr, if he had chosen to remain in the service. And then he suddenly threw up the service to go over to the Roman Church and become a Jesuit, and almost openly, with a sort of enthusiasm. It's true, he died in the nick of time. Everybody said so.
Mushkin was beside himself.
Pavlishchov went over to the Roman Church! Impossible! He cried in horror.
Impossible indeed, Ivan Petrovich drawled solidly. That's saying a good deal. And you must admit, dear prince, however you have such a high opinion of the deceased, he certainly was a most good-natured man, and to that I chiefly attribute the success of that rascal Guru. But ask me what a fuss and bother I had afterwards over that affair, especially with that very Guru. Only fancy, he turned suddenly to the old man, they even tried to put in a claim under the will, and I was forced to have recourse to the most, that is, to vigorous measures to bring them to their senses. For they're first-rate at that kind of thing. Wonderful people. But thank goodness it all happened in Moscow. I went straight to the court, and we soon brought them to their senses.
You wouldn't believe how you grieve and astonish me, cried Mushkin.
I'm sorry. But as a matter of fact, all this was, after all, a trifling business, and would have ended in smoke, as such things always do. I'm convinced of it. Last summer, he went on, turning to the old man, Countess K, I'm told, went into some Catholic convent abroad. Russians never can hold out if once they come under the influence of those rogues, especially abroad. It all comes from our weariness, the old dignitary mumbled authoritatively. And their manner of proselytizing is skilful and peculiar to them. They know how to scare people. They gave me a good scare, too, I assure you, in Vienna in 1832. But I wouldn't surrender. I ran away from them. Ha, ha, ha! I really did run away from them.
I heard, my dear sir, that you ran away from Vienna to Paris with the beauty Countess Levitsky. And that was why you flung up your purse, not to escape from the Jesuits,
Princess Bielokonski put in suddenly.
Well, you see, it was from a Jesuit. It turns out, after all, that it was from a Jesuit,
the old dignitary retorted, laughing at the agreeable recollection.
You seem to be very religious, which one doesn't often meet with nowadays in a young man,
he added, turning genially to Prince Lev Nikolaevich, who was listening open-mouthed and still amazed. The old man evidently wanted to study Mushkin more closely. He had for some reason become an object of interest to him.
Pavlichtchov was a clear-headed man and a Christian, a genuine Christian, Mushkin brought out suddenly. How could he have accepted a faith that's un-Christian? Catholicism is as good as an un-Christian religion, he added suddenly, looking about him with flashing eyes, as though scanning the whole company.
Oh, come, that's too much,
muttered the old man, and he looked with surprise at General Epanchin.
How do you mean Catholicism is an un-Christian religion?
Said Ivan Petrovich, turning round in his chair.
What is it, then?
An un-Christian religion in the first place, Mushkin began, in extreme agitation and with excessive abruptness. And in the second place, Roman Catholicism is even worse than atheism itself, in my opinion. Yes, that's my opinion. Atheism only preaches a negation, but Catholicism goes further. It preaches a distorted Christ, a Christ calumniated and defamed by themselves, the opposite of Christ. It preaches the Antichrist. I declare it does. I assure you it does. This is the conviction I have long held, and it has distressed me myself. Roman Catholicism cannot hold its position without universal political supremacy, and cries, non posthumus. To my thinking, Roman Catholicism is not even a religion, but simply the continuation of the Western Roman Empire, and everything in it is subordinated to that idea, faith to begin with. The Pope seized the earth, an earthly throne, and grasped the sword. Everything has gone on in the same way since, only they have added to the sword lying, fraud, deceit, fanaticism, superstition, villainy. They have trifled with the most holy, truthful, sincere, fervent feelings of the people. They have bartered it all for money, for base earthly power. And isn't that the teaching of Antichrist? How could atheism fail to come from them? Atheism has sprung from Roman Catholicism itself. It originated with them themselves. Can they have believed themselves? It has been strengthened by revulsion from them. It is begotten by their lying and their spiritual impotence. Atheism! Among us it is only the exceptional classes who don't believe, those who, as Yevgeny Pavlovich splendidly expressed it the other day, have lost their roots. But over there, in Europe, a terrible mass of the people themselves are beginning to lose their faith, at first from darkness and lying, and now from fanaticism and hatred of the Church and Christianity.
Mushkin paused to take breath. He had been talking fearfully fast. He was pale and breathless. They all glanced at one another, and at last the old dignitary simply burst out laughing. Prince N. drew out his lorgnette and took a prolonged stare at Mushkin. The German poet crept out of his corner and moved nearer to the table with a spiteful smile on his face.
You are exaggerating very much, Ivan Petrovich drawled with an air of being bored, and even rather ashamed of something. There are representatives of that church who are virtuous and worthy of all respect.
I have said nothing about individual representatives of the church. I was speaking of Roman Catholicism in its essence. I am speaking of Rome. Can a church disappear altogether? I never said that.
I agree, but all that's well known and irrelevant indeed. And it's a theological question.
Oh, no, no, no. It's not only a theological question, I assure you it's not. It concerns us much more closely than you think. That's our whole mistake, that we can't see that this is not exclusively a theological question. Why, socialism too springs from Catholicism and the Catholic idea. Like its brother atheism, it comes from despair in opposition to Catholicism on the moral side, to replace the lost moral power of religion, to quench the spiritual thirst of parched humanity, and to save them not by Christ, but also by violence. That too is freedom through violence. That too is union through sword and blood. Don't dare to believe in God. Don't dare to have property and individuality. Fraternité ou la mort. 2 millions of heads. By their works ye shall know them, as it is said. And don't imagine that all this is so harmless and without danger for us. Oh, we need to make resistance at once. At once. Our Christ, whom we have kept and they have never known, must shine forth and vanquish the West, not letting ourselves be slavishly caught by the wiles of the Jesuits, but carrying our Russian civilization to them. We ought to stand before them and not let it be said among us, as it was just now, that their preaching is skilful. But allow me, said Ivan Petrovich, growing dreadfully uneasy, looking about him and positively beginning to be terrified. All your ideas, of course, are very praiseworthy and full of patriotism, but all this is exaggerated in the extreme, and, in fact, we had better drop the subject. No, it's not exaggerated. It's even understated, positively understated, because I am not capable of expressing, allow me.
Mushkin ceased speaking, and sitting upright in his chair, gazed with a fixed and fervent look at Ivan Petrovich.
"I fancy you have been too much affected by what happened to your benefactor," the old dignitary indulgently observed, with unruffled composure. "You have grown over-ardent, perhaps from solitude. If you were to live more among people and to see more of the world, I expect you would be welcomed as a remarkable young man. Then, of course, you would grow less excitable, and you would see that it is all much simpler. And besides, such exceptional cases are due, in my opinion, partly to our being blasé, partly to our being bored."
Just so, cried Mushkin. "A splendid idea. It's just from dullness, from our dullness, not from being blasé. On the contrary, from unsatisfied yearning, not from being blasé. There you're mistaken. Not simply from unsatisfied yearnings, but from feverishness, from burning thirst, and don't think that it's to such a slight extent that one can afford to laugh at it. Excuse me, one needs to look ahead in these things. As soon as Russians feel the ground under their feet and are confident that they have reached firm ground, they are so delighted at reaching it that they rush at once to the furthest limit. Why is that? You are surprised at Pavlichtchov, and you put it down to madness on his part, or to simplicity. But it's not that. And Russian intensity in such cases is a surprise not to us only, but to all Europe. If one of us turns Catholic, he is bound to become a Jesuit, and one of the most underground. If he becomes an atheist, he's sure to clamour for the extirpation of belief in God by force, that is, by the sword. Why is this? Why such frenzy? You must surely know. Because he has found the fatherland, which he has missed here. He has reached the shore. He has found the land, and he rushes to kiss it. Russian atheists and Russian Jesuits are the outcome not only of vanity, not only of a bad vain feeling, but also of spiritual agony, spiritual thirst, a craving for something higher, for a firm footing, for a fatherland in which they have ceased to believe, because they have never even known it. It's easier for a Russian to become an atheist than for anyone else in the world. And Russians do not merely become atheists, but they invariably believe in atheism, as though it were a new religion, without noticing that they are putting faith in a negation. So great is our craving. He who has no roots beneath him has no God. That's not my own saying. It was said by a merchant, an old believer, whom I met when I was travelling. It's true he did not use those words. He said, "The man who has renounced his fatherland has renounced his God." Only think that among us, even highly educated people join the sect of flagellants. Though why is that worse than nihilism, Jesuitism, or atheism? It may even be rather more profound. But that's what their agony has brought them to. Reveal to the yearning and feverish companions of Columbus the new world. Reveal to the Russian the world of Russia. Let him find the gold, the treasure hidden from him in the earth. Show him the whole of humanity rising again and renewed by Russian thought alone, perhaps by the Russian God and Christ, and you will see into what a mighty and truthful, what a wise and gentle giant he will grow before the eyes of the astounded world, astounded and dismayed, because it expects of us nothing but the sword, nothing but the sword and violence, because, judging us by themselves, the other peoples cannot picture us free from barbarism. That has always been so hitherto, and goes on getting more so, and...
But at this point, an incident took place, and the speaker's eloquence was cut short in the most unexpected manner. This wild tirade, this rush of strange and agitated words and confused, enthusiastic ideas, which seemed tripping each other up and tumbling over one another in confusion, all seemed suggestive of something ominous in the mental condition of the young man who had broken out so suddenly, apropos of nothing. Those present who knew Mushkin wondered apprehensively, and some of them with shame, at this outbreak, which was so out of keeping with his habitual diffidence and restraint, with his rare and peculiar tact in some cases, and his instinctive feeling for real propriety. They could not understand what it was due to. What had been told him about Pavlishchov could not have been the cause of it. The ladies gazed at him from their corner, as though he had taken leave of his senses, and Princess Bielokonski confessed afterwards that in another minute she would have taken to her heels. The old gentlemen were almost disconcerted in their first amazement. The chief of the department looked sternly and with displeasure at him from his place. The colonel of engineers sat in absolute immobility. The German positively turned pale, but still smiled his artificial smile, looking at the rest of the company to see how they were taking it. But all this, and the whole scandal, might have ended in the most ordinary and natural way in another minute. General Epanchin, who was extremely astonished, though he grasped the situation sooner than the rest, had made several attempts to stop Mushkin already. But failing in his efforts, he was making his way towards him with a firm and resolute design. In another minute, he would perhaps, had it been necessary, have taken the extreme step of leading Mushkin out of the room in a friendly way on the pretext of his being ill, which would perhaps have been the truth, which the general fully believed himself. But the scene had a very different conclusion. At the beginning, when Mushkin at first entered the drawing-room, he had seated himself as far as possible from the china vase about which Aglaya had so scared him. It seems almost beyond belief, but after Aglaya's words the day before, a haunting conviction, a prodigious and incredible presentiment obsessed him that he would be sure to break the vase next day, however carefully he kept away from it and tried to avoid the disaster. But so it was. In the course of the evening, other and brighter impressions had flowed into his soul. We have spoken of that already. He forgot his presentiment. When he had heard Pavlishchov's name mentioned, and General Epanchin had brought him forward and introduced him again to Ivan Petrovitch, he moved nearer to the table and sat down in the very armchair nearest to the huge and handsome china vase, which stood on a pedestal almost at his elbow and a little behind him. At his last words, he suddenly rose from his seat and incautiously waved his arm, somehow twitching his shoulder, and there was a general scream of horror. The vase tottered at first, as though hesitating whether to fall upon the head of some old gentleman, but suddenly inclining in the opposite direction towards the German poet, who skipped aside in alarm, it crashed to the ground. A crash, a scream, and the priceless fragments were scattered about the carpet. Dismay and astonishment. What was Mushkin's condition would be hard and is perhaps unnecessary to describe. But we must not omit to mention one odd sensation, which struck him at that very minute, and stood out clearly above the mass of other confused and strange sensations. It was not the shame, not the scandal, not the fright, nor the suddenness of it that impressed him most, but his foreknowledge of it. He could not explain what was so arresting about that thought. He only felt that it had gripped him to the heart, and he stood still in a terror that was almost superstitious. Another instant, and everything seemed opening out before him. Instead of horror, there was light, joy, and ecstasy. His breath began to fail him, and... but the moment had passed. Thank God it was not that. He drew a breath and looked about him. He seemed for a long time unable to understand the fuss that was going on around him, or rather, he understood it perfectly and saw everything, but stood, as it were, apart, as though he had no share in it, and, like someone invisible in a fairy tale, had crept into the room and was watching people, with whom he had no concern, though they interested him. He saw them picking up the pieces, heard rapid conversations, saw Aglaia, pale, looking strangely at him, very strangely. There was no trace of hatred, no trace of anger in her eyes. She was looking at him with a frightened expression, but there was so much affection in it, and her eyes flashed so at the rest of the company, his heart ached with a sweet pain. At last he saw to his amazement that they had all sat down again and were positively laughing, as though nothing had happened. In another minute the laughter grew louder. They laughed, looking at him, at his dumb stupefaction, but their laughter was friendly and gay. Many of them addressed him, speaking so cordially, Lizaveta Prokofievna most of all. She spoke laughingly and said something very, very kind. Suddenly he felt General Epanchin slap him amicably on the shoulder. Ivan Petrovitch, too, was laughing, but the old dignitary was the most charming and sympathetic of all. He took Mushkin's hand, and with a faint squeeze of it and a light pat with the other hand, urged him to pull himself together, as though he were talking to a little frightened boy. Mushkin was highly delighted at this, and made him sit down beside him. Mushkin looked with pleasure into his face, and was somehow still unable to speak. His breath failed him. He liked the old man's face so much.
"What?" he muttered at last. "You really forgive me? You too, Lizaveta Prokofievna?"
The laughter was louder than ever. Tears came into Mushkin's eyes. He could hardly believe in it. He was enchanted.
"It was a fine vase, to be sure. I can remember it here for the last 15 years. Yes, 15,
Ivan Petrovitch was beginning.
"A terrible disaster, indeed. Even a man must come to an end, and all this to do about a clay pot,"
said Lizaveta Prokofievna in a loud voice.
"Surely you're not so upset over it, Leof Nikolaevich?"
she added, with a positive note of apprehension.
"Never mind, my dear boy, never mind. You'll frighten me, really. And you forgive me for everything?"
"For everything besides the vase." Mushkin would have got up from his seat, but the old man drew him again by the arm. He would not let him go.
"C'est très curieux, et c'est très sérieux,"
he whispered across the table to Ivan Petrovitch, speaking, however, rather loudly. Mushkin may have heard it.
"So I've not offended anyone. You can't think how happy I am at the notion, but that I was bound to be so. Could I possibly offend anyone here? I should be offending you again if I could think such a thing."
Calm yourself, my dear boy. This is all exaggerated, and there's nothing for you to be so grateful about. That's an excellent feeling, but exaggerated.
I'm not thanking you, I'm only admiring you. I'm happy looking at you. Perhaps I'm talking nonsense, but I must speak. I must explain, if only from self-respect.
All he said and did was spasmodic, confused, feverish. It is quite likely that the words he uttered were often not those he intended to use. His eyes seemed to ask whether he might speak. His glance fell upon Princess Bielokonski.
"It's all right, my dear boy. Go on, go on. Only don't be in such haste," she observed. "You began in such a breathless hurry just now, and you see what came of it. But don't be afraid to talk. These ladies and gentlemen have often seen queerer folk than you. They won't be surprised at you, and you are not so very remarkable either. You've done nothing but break a vase and given us all a fright."
Mushkin listened to her, smiling.
"Why, it was you,"
he began, addressing the old dignitary.
"It was you who saved a student called Podkumov and a clerk called Schwabrin from exile 3 months ago."
The old man positively flushed a little and muttered that he must calm himself.
"And I think it's you, I've heard," he turned at once to Ivan Petrovitch, "who gave your peasants timber to rebuild their huts when they were burnt out, though they were free and had given you a lot of trouble."
"Oh, that's exaggerated,"
muttered Ivan Petrovitch, though with an air of dignified pleasure. But this time it was true that Mushkin's words were exaggerated. It was only an incorrect rumour that had reached him.
"And did not you," he went on, addressing Princess Bielokonski, "receive me 6 months ago in Moscow, as though I had been your own son, when Lizaveta Prokofievna wrote to you. And exactly as though I had been your own son, you gave me one piece of advice, which I shall never forget. Do you remember? Why are you in such a state? Said Princess Bielokonski with vexation. You're a good-natured fellow, but absurd. If someone gives you a halfpenny, you thank him as though he had saved your life. You think it praiseworthy, but it's disgusting.
She was on the verge of being angry, but suddenly burst out laughing, and this time her laughter was good-humoured. Lizaveta Prokofievna's face brightened too. General Epanchin beamed.
I said that Lyov Nikolaevich was a man, if only he wouldn't be in such a hurry as the princess observed,
General Epanchin murmured in rapture, repeating Princess Bielokonski's words, which had struck him. Only Aglaya seemed mournful, but there was a flush, perhaps of indignation, in her face.
He really is very charming,
the old man muttered again to Ivan Petrovitch.
I came here with anguish in my heart, Mushkin went on, with increasing emotion, speaking more and more quickly, more and more queerly and eagerly. I was afraid of you, afraid of myself, too, of myself most of all. When I came back here to Petersburg, I determined that I would see the best people, the people of old family, of ancient lineage, to which I belong myself, among whom I am in the front rank by birth. Now I'm sitting with princes like myself, am I not? I wanted to get to know you, and it was necessary, very, very necessary. I've always heard too much that was bad about you, more than what was good, of your pettiness, the exclusiveness of your interests, your stagnation, your shallow education, and your ridiculous habits. Oh, so much is said and written about you. I came here today with curiosity and excitement. I wanted to see for myself and make up my own mind whether this upper crust of Russian society is really good for nothing and has outlived its time, is drained of its ancient life and only fit to die, but still persists in a petty, endless strife with the men of the future, getting in their way and not conscious that it is dying itself. I did not quite believe in this view before, because there never has been an upper class amongst us, except perhaps the courtiers, by uniform or by accident, and now it has quite disappeared. That's right, isn't it?
No, it's not right at all, said Ivan Petrovitch, smiling ironically.
There, he's off again, said Princess Bielokonski, losing patience.
Laissez le dire, he's trembling all over,
the old man warned them in an undertone. Mushkin had completely lost control of himself.
And what do I find? I find people elegant, simple-hearted and clever. I meet an old man who is ready to listen to a boy like me and be kind to him. I find people ready to understand and to forgive. Russian and kind-hearted, almost as kind and warm-hearted as I met there, and almost their equals. You can judge what a delightful surprise it is. Oh, do let me put it into words. I'd heard so often and fully believed myself that society was nothing but manners and antiquated forms and that all reality was extinct. But I see now for myself that that cannot be so among us. That may be anywhere else, but not in Russia. Can you all be Jesuits and frauds? I heard Prince N tell a story just now. Wasn't that simple-hearted, spontaneous humour? Wasn't it genuine frankness? Can such sayings come from the lips of a man who is dead, whose heart and talent have run dry? Could the dead have treated me as you have treated me? Isn't it material for the future, for hope? Can such people lag behind and fail to understand?
I beg you again, calm yourself, my dear boy. We'll talk about all this another time. I shall be delighted,
smiled the old dignitary. Ivan Petrovitch cleared his throat and turned round in his chair. General Epanchin made a movement. The chief of the department began talking to the old dignitary's wife, paying not the slightest attention to Mushkin. But the dignitary's wife frequently listened and glanced at him.
No, it's better for me to speak, you know,
Mushkin began again, with another feverish outburst, addressing the old man with peculiar trustfulness and, as it were, confidentially.
Yesterday, Aglaya Ivanovna told me not to talk, and even told me what subjects not to talk about. She knows I'm absurd on those subjects. I'm 27, but I know that I'm like a child. I have no right to express an opinion. I've said that long ago. It's only with Rogozhin in Moscow that I've talked openly. We read Pushkin together, the whole of him. He knew nothing of him, not even the name of Pushkin. I'm always afraid that my absurd manner may discredit the thought or the leading idea. I have no elocution. My gestures are always inappropriate, and that makes people laugh and degrades my ideas. I've no sense of proportion either, and that's the great thing. That's the chief thing, in fact. I know it's better for me to sit still and keep quiet. When I persist in keeping quiet, I seem very sensible, and what's more, I think things over. But now it's better for me to talk. I'm talking because you look at me so nicely. You have such a nice face. I promised Aglaya Ivanovna yesterday that I'd be silent all the evening.
Vraiment, smiled the old dignitary.
But sometimes I think that I'm not right in thinking that. Sincerity is more important than elocution, isn't it? Isn't it?
Sometimes.
I want to explain everything. 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 Oh, yes. You think I'm utopian, a theorist. My ideas are really all so simple. Don't you believe it? You smile. You know I'm contemptible sometimes, for I lose my faith. As I came here just now, I wondered, how shall I talk to him? With what word shall I begin, so that they may understand a little? How frightened I was. But I was more frightened for you. It was awful, awful. And yet, how could I be afraid? Wasn't it shameful to be afraid? What does it matter that for one advanced man there is such a mass of retrograde and evil ones? That's what I'm so happy about, that I'm convinced now that there is no such mass, and that it's all living material. There's no reason to be troubled, because we're absurd, is there? You know, it really is true that we're absurd, that we're shallow, have bad habits, that we're bored, that we don't know how to look at things, that we can't understand. We're all like that. All of us. You and I and they. And you are not offended at my telling you to your faces that you're absurd, are you? And if that's so, aren't you good material? Do you know, to my thinking, it's a good thing sometimes to be absurd? It's better, in fact. It makes it easier to forgive one another. It's easier to be humble. One can't understand everything at once. We can't begin with perfection all at once. In order to reach perfection, one must begin by being ignorant of a great deal. And if we understand things too quickly, perhaps we shan't understand them thoroughly. I say that to you, who have been able to understand so much already, and have failed to understand so much. I'm afraid for you now. You're not angry at a boy like me for saying things to you. Of course you're not. Oh, you know how to forget and to forgive those who have offended you, and those who have not offended you. For it's always more difficult to forgive those who have not offended one, and just because they've not injured one, and that therefore one's complaint of them is groundless. That's what I expected of the best people. That's what I was in a hurry to tell you as I came here, and did not know how to tell you. You are laughing, Ivan Petrovich. You think that I was afraid for them, that I'm their champion, a democrat, an advocate of equality? He laughed hysterically. He had been continually breaking into short laughs of delight. I'm afraid for you, for all of you, for all of us together. I'm a prince myself of ancient family, and I'm sitting with princes. I speak to save us all, that our class may not vanish in vain, in darkness, without realizing anything, abusing everything and losing everything. Why disappear and make way for others when we might remain in advance and be the leaders? If we are advanced, we shall be the leaders. Let us be servants in order to be leaders. He began to try to get up from his chair, but the old man still held him, though he looked at him with growing uneasiness. Listen, I know it's not right to talk. Better set an example. Better to begin. I've already begun, and can one really be unhappy? Oh, what does my grief, what does my sorrow matter if I can be happy? Do you know, I don't know how one can walk by a tree and not be happy at the sight of it. How can one talk to a man and not be happy in loving him? Oh, it's only that I'm notable to express it. And what beautiful things there are at every step, that even the most hopeless man must feel to be beautiful. Look at a child. Look at God's sunrise. Look at the grass, how it grows. Look at the eyes that gaze at you and love you. He had for some time been standing as he talked. The old man looked at him in alarm. Lizaveta Prokofievna cried out, "Oh, my God!" and threw up her hands in dismay, the first to realize what was wrong. Aglaya quickly ran up to him. She was in time to catch him in her arms, and with horror, with a face distorted with pain, she heard the wild scream of the spirit tearing and casting down the unhappy man. The sick man lay on the carpet. Someone hastened to put a pillow under his head. No one had expected this. A quarter of an hour later, Prince N., Yevgeny Pavlovich and the old dignitary were trying to restore the liveliness of the company, but within half an hour the party had broken up. Many words of sympathy and regret were uttered. A few comments were made. Ivan Petrovich remarked that the young man was a Slavophile, or something of the sort, but that there was nothing very dangerous about that, however. The old dignitary expressed no opinion. It's true that later on, next day and the day after, everyone who had been present seemed rather cross. Ivan Petrovich was positively offended, but not seriously so. The chief of the department was for some time rather cold to General Epanchin. The old dignitary, who was their patron, mumbled something by way of admonition to the father of the family,
though in flattering terms he expressed the deepest interest in Aglaé's future. He really was a rather good-hearted man, but one reason for the interest he had taken in Mushkin that evening was the part that the prince had played in the scandal connected with Nastasia Philipovna. He had heard something of the story and had been much interested by it, and would have liked indeed to ask questions about it. Princess Bielokonski said to Lizaveta Prokofievna as she took her leave that evening,
"Well, there's good and bad in him, and if you care to know my opinion, there's more bad than good. You can see for yourselves what he is. A sick man."
Madame Epanchin made up her mind once for all that as a bridegroom he was impossible, and that night she vowed to herself that, as long as she was living, he should not be the husband of Aglaé. She got up in the same mind next morning, but in the course of the morning, by lunchtime, at 1 o'clock, she was drawn into contradicting herself in an extraordinary way. In reply to her sister's carefully guarded question, Aglaé replied coldly, but haughtily, as it were, rapping it out,
"I have never given him a promise of any sort. I have never in my life looked on him or thought of him as my betrothed. He is no more to me than anyone else."
Lizaveta Prokofievna suddenly flared up.
"That I should never have expected of you," she said with chagrin. "As a suitor, he's out of the question, I know, and thank God that we're agreed about it. But I didn't expect such words from you. I looked for something very different from you. I'd be ready to turn away all those people who were here last night and to keep him. That's what I think of him."
At that point she stopped short, frightened at her words. But if only she had known how unjust she was to her daughter at that moment. Everything was settled in Aglaé's mind. She, too, was waiting for the hour that was to decide everything, and every hint, every incautious touch, dealt a deep wound to her heart.